Cindy Foster, and I'm the moderator, and I'd like to welcome you to the Promising Provider Practice session. Brooke Vallée was very nice to invite me to moderate. He's organized all this from the CDC. And we also have three distinguished presenters. We have Veronica Irvine, who's an orthodontist. We have Chris Stahl, who's a doctor, and we have Joan Orr, who is a health educator. The panel goal is to describe how the engagement of orthodontists, doctors in training, and public health educators can make a difference in promoting health and wellness and prevent childhood overweight. And I'd like to ask everyone in this room, who's had their orthodontist or their child's orthodontist recommend strategies on physical activity 60 minutes or more? Anybody? Who would like that? Who in this room has had their state tobacco tax go to wellness promotion activity? What? Couple. And who in this room would like the federal government to launch the PE program modeled after the lunch and breakfast program for Title I schools? And who in this room has had their doctor talk about not watching so much television or eating five or more fruits and vegetables? Not too many. This morning, we're going to have three distinguished panelists discuss their interventions. And our first one, I'm going to introduce each one before their five-minute presentation, and then we're going to take questions. This panel is primarily a question-answer panel. So it's going to be very participatory. So as you're listening to the five-minute presentation, please think of questions that you might want to ask the panelists as a whole or individually. And so our first speaker is Veronica Irvine, and she's worked at the San Diego State University Research Foundation for over 10 years, where she's currently an investigator with the Center for Behavior, Epidemiology, and Community Health. And she served as a data coordinator on a five-year NIH trial to increase bone density among preteens as the project coordinator for an NCI-funded longitudinal tobacco study among Koreans in California. She's currently a co-investigator on Dr. Mel Hovell's newly funded NCI trial aimed to increase physical activity, reduce sedentary practices, and promote healthy diets among preteens who obtain orthodontry care. Ms. Irving earned her master's in public health and epidemiology from SDSU, that's San Diego State University. She's currently in her third year as a doctoral student in the joint UC San Diego and SDSU program in public health. Thank you, Veronica.
Great. Hello. Thank you. So I'm not an orthodontist, and I've been doing this kind of research for about 10 years. So we have a very quick presentation, and today I will be presenting a new trial that Dr. Hovell's a PI on. Healthy Smiles is an orthodontist program. Our projects are based off of principles of behavior and learning. This current study will use orthodontia to provide advice to parents and children to make small changes to their diet and activity. A small change, such as replacing soda at the dinner table with water and milk, are more feasible, are more likely to be maintained, and can have a significant impact when applied across a large population. We will also be trying to establish internal contingencies to maintain the behavior in the family. This is a very simple illustration of a contingency, where B is the behavior, A is the antecedent to the behavior, and C is its consequence. So we would have a doctor advise a parent and child to replace chips with fruit at one meal. The child takes strawberries to their lunch, which they share with a friend who enjoys them and in turn asks their parents for strawberries. The original child's behavior is reinforced by their friend's encouragement, and they may be likely to share their story with their doctor at their next visit. And we're hoping that would then encourage more advice and clinician counseling by receiving encouragement from their parents and children. This is one tiny example, but we're hoping to start hundreds of these in each office, and then imagine this clinician-wide, office-wide. Our experience with clinician counseling has been with orthodontists. An orthodontist are a non-traditional and underutilized clinician who can serve to promote preventative care. And our first trial was used orthodontists to provide tobacco prevention materials. And that study resulted in a 25% reduction in tobacco initiation among susceptible preteens. Recently, we've conducted pilot research with orthodontia and their patients to promote diet and activity in the orthodontist's office. And what we found out is that orthodontists see children every 6 to 8 weeks for up to 4 years. They also provide services to preteens as well as to a diverse population. Almost all the offices were already providing some sort of nutritional counseling as it pertained to dental health. And about half the offices were already providing education materials on nutrition, but again, as it pertains to dental health. When we surveyed the parents and the clinicians, the majority were very interested in non-dental health being promoted in the office. So even though the orthodontist office is a current starting point, our pilot revealed that there are still areas of improvement, one being that the orthodontists were not providing systematic advice across continuously. They were not targeting whole body health. They were not set up to provide feedback or to be evaluated. So we took these preliminary findings to NIH, and we were very fortunate to be funded by NCI to test a larger version of this model. We will recruit 40 offices and 1,700 youth in San Diego County to a 2-year intervention. Half the offices will be randomized to a diet and activity intervention, and the other half will serve as control groups and receive tobacco prevention materials. At each visit, the parent and child will receive brief counseling plus a formal prescription from the orthodontist to make one small behavior change. At the next visit, the orthodontist will ask about their strategies and whether they succeeded in making that change, and then they will set a second target behavior change. While in the waiting room, parents and children will be exposed to educational materials, print, hands-on, and electronic. Every other month, we're going to rotate the materials in the office as well as the prescription message to provide a variety of strategies to parents and children. And our goal is to show that repeated clinician counseling can help to normalize BMI among adolescents. Our policy implications would be to develop office practice systems as well as training standards for medical and dental residents, and I believe that Chris Stahl and Joan Orr will both be presenting information on that, as well as financial compensation for preventative care, not only within the pediatric medical setting, but also within the dental setting. And if you're interested in learning more, please contact the PI, Dr. Hovell, the project coordinator, Katie Schmitz, or myself. We welcome to answer more questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So our second panelist is Joan Orr, and she's the project director for the Maine Youth Overweight Collaborative at the Maine Center for Public Health, and also leads activities related to the Maine Harvard Prevention Research Center strategic plan. Joan is a certified health education specialist with a bachelor's degree in community health and a minor in nutrition from the University of Maine in Farmington. Before returning to school, Joan worked in senior management position in a multi-million-dollar apparel firm. So she's multidisciplinary within herself. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. All right. Well, I'm very pleased to be here, and it's really exciting to see so many people here to hear about providers, even though there was a little bit yesterday said about, you know, providers are not at the top of the, are not going to reach the most number of people, but I tend to differ, and I'll tell you why as I kind of go through my presentation a little bit. About the Maine Youth Overweight Collaborative, we affectionately call it MYOC. It originated from a conference that we have annually with some interested clinicians. There were three waves of teams that we've worked with since 2004. We currently have reached about 150,000 clinicians, or 150,000 children, and about 150 clinicians across the state. The Maine Harvard Prevention Research Center is very generous in providing us with in-kind evaluation guidance and data analysis, and one of my colleagues is here from Boston, so it's really nice to have her support here in the crowd. The Maine AAP, as well as the National AAP, has also been very, very supportive. the main group, a lot of their executive committee have been on a lot of our teams, and the National AAP recently just helped us by providing support and willingness to publish our clinical decision support chart. So you can purchase this from the National AAP, and there's a lady in the audience from them. We also have the major health systems across our state, the PAN program, and other generous funders and so on. I just wanted to make sure I got all of those folks in. How many of you are familiar with the chronic care model or the IHI model for collaborative learning? Okay, great. So this is what our program is based on. It is these two models. We identified key changes within the chronic care model, all of the components for our practices to work on, and then we bring our practice teams together according to the IHA Breakthrough Series so they can learn from each other and from other experts nationally. So we identified these goals as part of the chronic care model, that we would recognize the patient and family at the center of the team, make sure that the provider is not the sage on the stage, but necessarily, you know, providing guidance from the side. We use a 5210 behavioral screening tool to tailor an intervention, and I did bring some handouts. I don't know if there were enough for all of you, but our little healthy habits survey I'll talk about in a minute is in that handout. We wanted to make sure that we engage practices, not just providers, not just the travel teams that were coming to our collaborative learning. We wanted them to assess, classify, and track BMI percentile for age, gender on all children, and to translate guidelines into practice to follow the recommendations that came out in 2007. And that was part of the reason that we came up with our clinical decision support chart. And finally, to use data not to manage not just patients but populations, really putting that public health approach to clinical practice, and then partnering with schools and community organizations to impact healthy lifestyles. As we all know, when patients leave, they're spending about 80 to 90% of their time outside their provider's office. So this is our message. We adopted a 5210 message. 521 Jump Up and Go in Massachusetts from Blue Cross and Blue Shield was very generous in sharing their initial products with us. We added the zero. We thought that was really important to emphasize the sugar-sweetened beverages. This is just a little bit of data around, you know, that I use as I talk about things in Maine, because we all know that you have to bring the data home locally in order for people to say, yeah, that's happening here. These are the tools, as I mentioned, the clinical decision support chart. We also have developed a toolkit that gives the providers not only some tools for them to use in the office as they're talking with patients and families around making sure they understand the message, but handouts as they're developing goals and setting objectives with patients to leave the practice that they can use as those patient education materials, and I brought one with me. Be happy to share that with anybody afterwards. As I mentioned, we have three cohorts of teams that we've been working with. We have a final summit that we will be having in September of this year, where we're going to compare and contrast the data from all three of these waves of teams using pretty much the same information. So what have we learned so far that our provider teams, and we do survey all the providers in the practice, not just the travel team, to make sure that our key changes have spread. They have better attitudes, higher levels of confidence, increased use of medical evaluation counseling and goal setting. And as far as assessment and tracking, at baseline, about 38% of them were doing BMI screening percentile at all well-child checks. It's now 94. At baseline, they were classifying only 19% of the time. Now they're doing it 75% of the time. And, of course, at baseline, they did not use the 5-to-1 survey at all, and now 82% of them are doing that. When we look at parent caretaker information as to what they're hearing from their providers as they go to these visits, as you can see, a good number of them are hearing about the 5210 message at all of the visits. And then we asked, if you were setting a goal, how well are you doing at keeping those goals? And these were the kinds of information that we got about fruits and vegetables, physical activity, TV screen time, and sugar-sweetened beverages. Finally, our next steps are to incorporate motivational interviewing more so into our practice. We do training around that, but we find it's really, really important. It's really important in helping patients and families set what they want to do. This is really what we call a quality improvement effort. It's really about healthcare reform. It's about patients leaving happier, about providers feeling happier about the interaction. And once they learn MI, they realize it's something that they can use no matter what the topic is that the patient wants to prioritize for that day. Looking at innovative approaches for follow-up, we don't have a lot in our state to do that, so making sure that we do that, and there's several pilot interventions that I hope somebody will ask me about that I can use another minute later on to tell you about, to get support from top administration for our practices to go out. We're actually encouraging RVUs for community work, so if physicians go out and are advocates in the community, and that's why I think that they can do more than just clinical practice, because they're really great voices, valid information from them. Lack of referral options and improvement spread. And for those of you that got a handout, we did develop a position statement for our health systems to use, asking them about sustainability. That's it for me.
That was great. I use motivational interviewing with my husband every day. It's a great way to practice. Okay. Our third panelist is Dr. Chris Stahl, and she's co-chair of the Clinical Practices Working Group in the Consortium to Lower Obesity in Chicago Children, or CLOC. As a result of participation in and with the help of this group, Dr. Stahl developed the 5-4-3-2-1-GO resident education project that she'll be talking about today. She's also in charge of teaching adolescent medicine to pediatric residents, medical students, and others at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And her current engagement with the struggle to reduce youth obesity includes serving in a multidisciplinary adolescent obesity program that includes a bariatric surgery option, a teaching clinic for pediatric residents in adolescent weight management, and the advisory committee for the Illinois chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics project. A lot of American Academy of Pediatrics activity. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, 5-4-3-2-1-GO is a community health education effort that CLOC sponsored, and the resident education project was an attempt to engage providers in capturing the same message in the office so that we would get duplication of the message and hopefully more uptake of the message by patients. And I have two collaborators in this from two different institutions. I'm at UIC, Jonathan Nicholas at Children's Memorial, and Jay Mayevsky is at Cook County Hospital, now known as Stroger. So this is the flyer that's being used for community health education. We didn't skip any numbers. 5-4-3-2-1, go. So it's 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, 4 servings of water, 3 servings of low-fat dairy, 2 hours or less of screen time, and 1 hour or more of physical activity a day. So over the past couple of years, CLOC has targeted Vanguard communities. They're in purple, and you can see where the clinics are, where the residents practiced that we were training. There were a number of activities that took place. These were GO team activities. These were youth teams who went out to park districts and multiple other sites in the community to talk about 5-4-3-2-1-GO in a variety of different ways, including play activities. And those were in the summer and fall of 2007, and this was in the summer of 2007-08. So we're trying to coordinate what we're doing clinically with what we were doing in the community. And we wanted something that we could train people quickly, a large number of people quickly, and get it disseminated so it could be coordinated in real time. And I think this is a very important feature of trying to work with coordination of messages, especially in this time when we're not quite sure exactly what the message should be. So we hypothesized we could train healthcare providers to reinforce this message in clinic and to help parents or teens develop an individualized change plan, and that would be an additive that we could do in clinic that we couldn't do in the community in presentations. And we developed a worksheet, which included a 5-4-3-2-1-GO history from about the child, asked the parent and the kid to set goals for changes. We had an adolescent version and a younger child version, asked when they'd start changing, and for if you had enough time, preparatory goals. And we wanted to do it in 5 minutes. We developed a web-based training that was about 45 minutes long, included a couple of vignettes, talked about strategies for engaging parents and teens in behavior change, which did not start with showing them their BMI percentile, and did start with asking them if they'd be willing to talk about healthy eating and physical activity. Covered the message content, and there was pre- and post-testing for the residents built into the training. So we did focus a bit on motivational interviewing spirit, although we did not try to train people in motivational interviewing. We did emphasize giving patients a change plan in writing and planning follow-up checks on how that plan went. We then recruited residents from 23 clinics. We included controls, and about 119 residents were recruited, and the controls trained after. And we found that they learned things about the recommended number of servings of fruits and vegetables and dairy products and recommendations for physical activity and also how to use a more engagement-based strategy. So we got some good but not perfect learning in the residents. We then called patients. The residents collected a couple of cards, hopefully, from patients that they were seeing in their clinics. This was targeted to 2 to 18-year-olds, so we didn't have them talk to any patients under 2. And we then interviewed by phone 2 to 6 weeks later. And what the parents reported to us, about 95% of the interviewees were parents, about 5% were adolescents, that their kids, in fact, had made some positive changes. So we were seeing a 2.5-fold increase in positive eating and drinking changes, and also improvement in screen time and activity. And we saw a 3-fold increase in the likelihood of making a plan or 5-fold increase of putting it in writing. So we concluded that this web-based training was feasible, was well-received by the residents, although they did comment to us in our focus groups with them afterwards that they really felt like they needed more backup. They weren't aware that we were doing this in the community, and they got very excited because there was a TV show that came out around time that featured some of the GO team participants, and the residents came running to me and said, "We saw it on television, this is great, we're not alone." and that we could coordinate in real time with the community-based health education and use some of the same materials. And we have now gotten continuing medical education credit for this through the UIC, and you can actually access this training. You don't have to be a physician to access it. You can weave your way through the CLOCK website. and that's the end of my little presentation.
All right. Well, thank you so much to our three panelists for keeping in time. I know we have lots of burning questions. I'm going to open up with a question, and then we'll also take questions from the audience. So one of our first questions that we'd like to ask the panelists is, how would this all of your work work across diverse populations? In other words, how would you see your work working in a population, maybe not the one that you're working with currently? Anyone want to make a comment?
All right, I'll start because we're working with orthodontists, and that is a concern that people have. So our pilot data from San Diego has shown that 60% of our clinics are located in neighborhoods that are below the median household income. About 50% of the patients, 30% of the offices use DentaCal, which serves low and income populations. And when we surveyed the parents, about 50% were racial and ethnic minorities. About 75% of our offices provided bilingual staff. So we do feel that we will have a diverse sample within our group. But in order to control for that, we will be including equal number of offices from lower income neighborhoods. But more importantly, we believe that the association should still remain across the diverse sample. So in our tobacco prevention study, we did see a 25% reduction in tobacco initiation, and that was held constant when we looked at sub-analyses across racial and ethnic groups. And we foresee that should still be the same when we look at diet and activity changes with BMI.
Our program works very well, particularly with low income. You know, Maine is a predominantly white state, and we have very few racial or ethnic minorities across the state, other than in a few pockets in some of our larger cities. So, even though we were looking at low income as being one of our focuses, we did look at our main care, our Medicaid population, and we have a pilot program with our public health nursing that helps address that. We also work with our cooperative extension on several of their programs where they go into families' homes and so on and help them to look at behavior change or eat on a budget and do things like that. But I'm glad that Wendy actually raised this, because one of the big concerns that we've had around our message is the cultural implications. How does our 5210 message really translate to a Somali population or Latino population? Because we do have pockets of those that, as I mentioned, work and live in our larger cities. So we are conducting some focus groups. We are starting to look at that. We are trying to be very careful about how we work around that message and if there are changes that we need to make to it in order to really adapt it to work for a larger population, then we will certainly make sure that we do that.
So I think the problem is barriers. You can make these recommendations and the parents can have the desire to carry them out. But time and again, what we hear from patients is, I can't let my kid outside, he's going to get shot. I can't get fruits and vegetables in my neighborhood, and I don't, it's hard to lug all this stuff back, and I don't really have time, I'm working all the time. So we find many people have social barriers to realizing the goals. On the other hand, I think it's very important for patients to know that these are the recommendations, and I don't think they have known. I don't think it's always been that clear, and I think that's different. I think there's a disparity across socioeconomic class in terms of how commonly this knowledge is held. So that's how I think it cuts.
Thank you very much. One more question, and then I'd like to open it up to audience. This is a big, long question, so and people can answer in the audience, too. We're not just limited to our panel necessarily. But what policies, federal, state, school, or work-based, are most likely to achieve an obesity-reducing change in types of fluid intake or physical activity? And would such policies be likely to reduce health disparities? That's a long one, huh? anyone want to take a crack at that?
So I'm going to talk about the soda tax. Because I think it's interesting that in your study, there's no reduction in soda. Did I see that slide right?
It's one of the goals that they choose most often, but it's not necessarily one that...
And although it's not, we've had some debate because it's not one of our recommendations to do zero sodas, and that was to try to keep the message positive, is my understanding. And yet, what we found with our control residents, that was frequently a recommendation, and they didn't get greater reduction in soda intake. So I don't think giving that message in and of itself is effective. And so I think we need another approach, and we have a model for tobacco where we know that tobacco use goes down when we tax it. And so I think that's a very sound approach policy-wise.
I would agree. I mean, I think soda is the number one, and certainly the soda tax is on everybody's mind as we move forward across the nation, not just in our individual states. But I'd say, to pick another topic, that putting PE back into our schools, that's the next thing that we really want to do in Maine. That's one of the focuses that we have, is that, we have a lot of different climate across our seasons. It's really hard to get out in the wintertime. So we're really trying to encourage what options kids have to be able to go out. It's not all about team sports. It's about things that you can do individually. And I think that, if we can get a focus on that back into our school systems, and what we've tried to do to emphasize that is to tie it to learning. And so I think that if you look, there's a lot of different research articles, there's a lot of evidence growing out there around kids learning better when they're able to be physically active during the school day. So it not only has the health implications, but it really does have a learning implication that I think schools can adopt if they really start to think about it.
And for us, we would like to talk about have talking about diet and activity be more normal. So having, when you go to any type of provider, not just your pediatrician, not just your dentist, but just having when you're at other types of providers, the discussion of what is a healthy diet, how can you get outside more to be active. And we were concerned that, or the orthodontists originally in our study were concerned that maybe the parents and patients wouldn't want to discuss nutrition, but that was not at all what we saw. Parents are really interested in providing nutrition, not about being on a diet, but how to be healthy, and they liked having the dentist staff talking about that kind of information to their child. So I think just being more open-minded about discussing diet and activity in our daily lives.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to just plug the PE one more time. We addressed food insecurity and hunger with the federally funded lunch program. I can't see why we can't have a federally funded PE program for our Title I schools where PE teachers are supported through the feds so that the underfunded, low-income schools who don't have PTAs to fund their PE teachers can also have PE teachers. And again, it will not only address and improve learning, but it also will be a great stimulus package because it would address and help employment all across the country. And there are a lot of trainers out of business right now because of the slump in the economic market. So there are a lot of people out there who actually are even trained to do this. So I'd like to now open it up to the audience. Please come up to the microphone if you don't mind so we can all hear.
Hi, my name is Deirdre Fisher. I'm actually a patient care director for an adolescent unit here in Northern Virginia. And my question is to ask you about how do you address the stigma of obesity in starting these conversations and addressing it? I find working with adolescents, there's a lot of the unknown truths, and almost seems to me as a healthcare provider, it's like where we were 20 years ago with mental health issues. And my second question was around how do you design a BMI recommendation for more of our chronic kids or kids who are not our normal children, but more may have disabilities or different issues? Thank you.
I think that, you know, the stigma around discussing obesity is a really strong area for us to make sure that we address when we go out and talk with our clinical practice teams. And we do start off by saying, how do you feel about your own weight? You know, how do you feel about role modeling this? And one of our speakers yesterday said, you know, it's really great to have somebody who's struggling with their own weight to be able to address it with a family. But one of the things that we really try to emphasize is that we not necessarily talk about BMI. That's why we use our 5210 message. We kind of call it a space blanket. The survey is filled out by the family or the child, depending on their age, as they're sitting in the waiting room waiting to go in for their visit. It's used as a foundation of discussion with the provider around behavior and what kind of behaviors are you currently engaging in and what would you like to change about that. And we don't necessarily even bring up BMI. The only time that a physician or a clinician might do that is if somebody's in a real, you know, serious state of denial and they want to really make a point of the issue, or if a patient asks. And we do try to put out more information, posters, things like that around the waiting rooms, around the exam rooms, so that it's not scary to parents, so that they can look at a chart, they know what the physician is doing, they know what they're doing when they're plotting it, and we really also emphasize that it's about tracking it over time. So it's not just a point in time and that it's only a screening tool, it's not a diagnostic tool. So making sure that all of that educational piece happens as well so that if a patient or a family does ask and we start pointing that out, that we can say this is where Johnny was, you know, when he was this age, this is where he is now, this is a little bit concerning. You know, we show them the curve because there is adiposity rebound that happens. So it's really about making sure that they understand what it is they're looking at as well if we do happen to go there.
Okay, so this comes up a lot, and it came up in our study because the residents kept wanting to use this only with the overweight kids, and we really had to say, listen, the only kids you shouldn't use this with are the kids who have some kind of special need that would make one of these pieces of advice inappropriate for them, and then you might want to figure out how to adapt the message rather than just omitting it. Now, this isn't really addressing your question, which is I have a kid who's going to feel stigmatized if I talk about this, and maybe he's going to feel that way whether I talk about it or whether I don't talk about it. For adolescents, our state IDPA covers a screening tool called GAPS, the Guidelines for Adolescent Preventative Services. It's available online through the AMA. It's a questionnaire. And included in that questionnaire, in addition to the usual sex and drugs and do you wear a seatbelt questions, are questions about how do you feel about your body. And it's a great tool to use because obviously that questionnaire is there for everybody. We're not just giving it to the overweight kids. And once that kid is endorsed that they're concerned about their eating or they're concerned about their weight and they spend a lot of time thinking about how to be thin, then I have an entree into discussing that. But I really agree with this. We've emphasized BMI so much to clinicians that what they want to do is get out the growth curve and say, hey, you're overweight. And that's not the best starter thing because people feel labeled and they then immediately start defending themselves. So I'm with Joan on this. You start by asking people if it's okay to have a discussion.
And also, we do not do BMI counseling in our study at all. It's all healthy nutrition and healthy activity, and it's applied to all the children in the study, regardless of weight. So,
George Flores, the California Endowment. In our experience, when you engage providers about obesity prevention, these are clinicians, the first question is about reimbursement and where do I find the time? So it's a time factor as well as a money factor. And then you engage them and go through programs of education like NICHQ has. And then the second question is about reimbursement and time. And it goes down the list in just about every encounter when you especially encounter new groups of clinicians. It's always about those factors, and we haven't really solved that. I think insurers, Medicare, Medicaid especially, and other programs still have to find a way, I think, to allow for clinicians to become engaged in this in a more meaningful way and make it a higher priority. And I think colleagues in particular settings like community clinics and school-based clinics in particular should be given ways to engage in the issue because they tend to have more of a population focus and tend to deal with populations that are maybe even at higher risk for obesity. And I don't know if any of you would like to speak to either of those factors, the time issue, the reimbursement issue, or school-based clinics and community clinics and special efforts in those settings.
I'll speak to the time issue first. We did ask our providers and our practice teams how long it was taking to add our intervention to their protocol in their office systems, and the majority of them overwhelmingly said under 4 minutes. So what we've done is we've really taken this as a team approach. The receptionist is responsible for passing out the survey. You know, the medical assistant or other person on staff, you know, checks the BMI and does some of the work. The clinician discusses the survey, but it's really part of the exam, as part of their discussion period. And what we also found was that once we started emphasizing motivational interviewing and the fact that, you know, you want to talk about what it is the family or the child really brought to this appointment as being their top issue, that whether it was 4 minutes on obesity or 4 minutes on their asthma problem or whatever, that it was really still the same 4 minutes. So it was really a question of deciding was talking about healthy behaviors or talking about weight issues or, you know, if that was where they wanted to go, really the emphasis, and really it was, then it was that 4 minutes that was being used. So whether it was really taking an additional 4 minutes, most of the providers we talked to said, probably not really. What's happening is that I'm just emphasizing that over something else because that's what my patient or family told me that we wanted to talk about. As far as reimbursement, we've been really lucky in the state of Maine that we really have not had any reimbursement problems. But to speak to what the lady in the audience addressed, we do not also have a lot of good backdrop for follow-up or for tertiary care. So a lot of our appointments are primary care-based appointments or follow-up being brought back to primary care, not going out to those specialty referrals or the other types of reimbursement services that overweight patients or families really need to get for really proactive care for that particular problem. So I do recognize that, you know, there are reimbursement issues as we move down that path. And I think that there are a lot of good things happening across the nation to help address that. I think as we talk about it more and people recognize it as a medical condition more, that it's going to be covered more. And that's part of the reason that we really encourage our primary care practices to code for that as being a problem, so that the information is out there. Payers are seeing it on reimbursement claims that are coming through, and they're recognizing that what the severity of the problem really is, and that physicians are recognizing it. So those would be my two points.
I'm going to comment on school-based health centers because I work in one, and I've done counseling in that setting. And there's a drawback, which is I worked in a high school, and the parents aren't there, and the parents a lot of times have a major input to what the food environment and options are at home. And I get to know the barriers at the school level intimately and bang my head against them a lot. I think the primary benefit in the school-based health center, you do have a little bit longer for counseling, that's true, but then you quickly reach the limits of what counseling can do in contexts that are very limited. What you do have the opportunity to do, not so much me as a physician, but other members of our clinic who often engage in organizing the youth who are patients to lobby for our clinic, is to help engage those youth in organizing for change in some of the school factors. It's also a great place for fruit and vegetable distribution. We did a project one year, and I was giving out fruit the whole year, and it was very interesting because the first day I had it there, a parent came by, and she said, oh, can I take some of these? The kids are not going to eat these. And I said, well, take one. But by the end of the year, I couldn't keep the fruit bowl filled for more than an hour of clinic. So it was very interesting.
I think for the school settings, again, ours is looking at orthodontia care, but it's looking as a model of what could happen if you had repeated counseling. And the school setting would be ideal for seeing the same children repeatedly and checking up, providing feedback, and actually monitoring their goal progress. So we would like to see a repeated clinician advice. And in terms of reimbursement, we are providing very small reimbursement, but what we found out was that most of the offices really want to provide people more for their money nowadays, and so giving them preventative care to them was giving them more for what they were coming to for their clinic.
Can I just make one other comment about that? I actually do have a clinic where I partner with a dietitian, and I actually have better reimbursement rates there than I do in my adolescent gynecology clinic. So, I mean, but many of those children have comorbidities, so we're actually billing for the comorbidity first and the obesity second. But
thank you. I think that this demonstrates how it really, again, we need to collaborate with multidisciplinary groups to solve the challenges of reimbursement and the challenges that we face in a clinical setting. And as an example, Harvinder Serene is working with a group that I'm working with the National Association for Children's Hospitals, to just look at this issue of reimbursement. And we're looking at trying to figure out how we can strategize to reimburse a multidisciplinary team that's dealing with the more morbidly obese child, so that the physician and the dietitian and the physical therapist and the psychologist can be reimbursed in a manner that would make it effective in the long term. And just to also illustrate, our panelists mentioned team approach, MI, and the environment as key components to a strategy that's effective and efficient. And I think that also they presented in their presentation that they have also developed a lot of tools and messaging that have allowed them to be able to really deliver their care in an efficient manner. And I think the tools and messaging goes along with the change of environment as well. And so I just wanted to re-emphasize those points as well.
Yeah. I have two or three comments I'd like to make and would appreciate a response. I'm Judy Robinson with the American Society of Bariatric Physicians. And our whole goal is to support physicians in helping their obese patients and the comorbidities that go along with it. So I'm very pleased to hear more discussion that obesity is truly a medical condition. However, I think the science is now showing that a BMI is not the only indicator. So what we're seeing is that a number of physicians who aren't well educated get a BMI and say, go to Jenny Craig, go to Weight Watchers, without really looking at the metabolic issues that are involved in that whole process. We just started this past year offering an introduction one-day course to mostly internal medicine and family physicians on managing weight loss. And the evaluations are overwhelming that the physicians are not knowledgeable about what to do with obese patients. They don't know how to talk to them. And they are very, very supportive of the education we're now providing. So those are a couple things that have been of concern in what I've been hearing. So I just would like your response.
I would reinforce that I think physicians are extraordinarily poorly educated with respect to a nutrition that's relevant to obesity, with respect to some of the mental health components that accompany it, and with counseling techniques. And I think this was really well reflected a week ago in Perry Klass's health column in the New York Times, where she talked about her sense of not feeling competent in counseling overweight kids, partly because of her own status as being overweight and feeling hypocritical about it. It was really a sad column, and I wanted to say, you know, you really can do this. You can make a change. You can help people change things, and we can turn this around. This, you know, this happened over the last few decades, this tripling of the rates, and there are a lot of components to it, but we can be part of the solution as providers. We don't have to just step back and say, oh, it's all the environment. We have no role in doing this. And I think when the providers do not speak, their silence says a lot to patients. I've sat with morbidly obese teenagers and their very overweight mother right next to them, and I say, who else in your family is overweight? And no one is. And then I ask the mom, do you think you're overweight? And she'll say, well, I think I am, but I went to the doctor and they didn't say anything to me about it. So I think the absence, when we don't speak as providers, we're giving the wrong message about what's happening.
We spend a lot of time, at the beginning of our collaborative process talking with our teams and making sure that the clinical practice site is ready to come on board with what we're asking them to do. And one of the things that we ask them to start with in the first 3 months of working with us is to try to role model what it is they're asking their patients to do. So if, in fact, they've decided to join us, then we say, all right, how does the 5210 message work in the environment of your clinic? You know, what kind of messages are you sending around that? How do you feel about it yourself? How do you feel about, trying to pick a goal and work on it yourself? So that we ask them to kind of try to experience what it is they're asking their patients to experience before they ever go down that path. The other thing that I want to address from the lady who spoke about from bariatric surgery is that I totally agree. I mean, I think that we found that our physicians and our clinicians really do not understand as primary care physicians where to draw the line, what they think they can handle, what they don't think they can handle, and being educated around it. So this is where the learning collaborative process and bringing them together for learning sessions 3 to 4 times over the course of working with them, we really try to emphasize what are the clinical guidelines, what are the things that you need to know. We bring in experts, endocrinologists, gastroenterologists, and ask them to speak about the issues so that they can learn about all of the medical indications and implications so that they are addressing those down the path before they decide to make a specialty referral. So we're trying to really give them the tools. Our clinical decision support chart has a lot of that information in it from the 2007 guidelines, and they tell us they use this a lot, as they're learning about what it is they should do and what they shouldn't do. And so I think it's really important for primary care to really get to that point where they feel comfortable with what they should address, but also knowing what they shouldn't address. And that's really a learning curve as part of our work.
Yeah, one more question, but just to also give people some hope, this Fit for Resident program that's a collaborative between the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Academy of Family Practice, and the CDC is participating funded by Anthem Blue Cross Foundation that we're working on at UCLA, is developing a core curriculum for residents in family practice and in pediatrics so that they have a guide for teaching the residents nutrition and physical activity, promotion and also prevention messages for their patients. So that this will this is piloted in California this year from 5 residency programs and comparison sites, and then it will go national in about a year or two. So this is it's a guide that will then draw on resources like the resources that have been developed from this panel as well as the AAP. And so I think that there's a real huge movement to train people in training, not just do the catch-up afterwards.
Yeah, I am part of the CDC-funded statewide obesity prevention partnership in New Jersey, and I happen to be the physical activity specialist for a I want to make sure that we engage doctors as advocates. Now, we have the New Jersey Association of the New Jersey chapter of the AAP, and I better make sure family practice is in there. Anyone else in this room give me suggestions for how to identify either groups or even individual physicians in New Jersey that can go to bat for us, maybe if we decide to start promoting certain policy changes or so on? I think physicians are highly credible sources of information, and I don't want to miss that. And I'll sit down.
Lori Winter-Summers, is she on your... Yeah. Oh, Feldman Winter. Feldman, that's it, Feldman. Yeah. She's very involved in the breastfeeding advocacy, and then that, of course, is the natural segue for prevention and treatment or prevention of overweight. I guess we have one more burning question. Sorry.
It's a quick question, maybe.
Okay.
I'm Jennifer DeWall with the Iowa Department of Public Health. And I know that you had just spoke a little bit about, training residents on educating obese patients or overweight patients on nutrition and physical activity. Do you have any steps to take to possibly change medical school curriculum so that they're actually taught how to address these things before they even get to residency?
Can I just jump in for the dentist side? I do know that they're currently working on changing some of the curriculum in the dentist program, and a woman from UC San Diego has developed the curriculum for the dental school, and her name is Jeannie Wong, H-U-A-N-G, and she is trying to get the curriculum. She's going around right now going to different universities to get it into the dental clinic, into the dental curriculum for dental residents. She's from UC San Diego, but she's going nationwide.
We do have some obesity curriculum integrated into our medical school curriculum. Unfortunately, nutrition and biochemistry have been coordinated, so I keep telling them it needs to be coordinated with behavioral science rather than with biochemistry. I think that would make a better mix, but that hasn't been taken up yet.
If you go on the Danon Institute, they also have developed CD-ROMs in the late 90s that need to be updated, but it was developed with UNC in a collaboration of other medical schools that are case-based learning for nutrition and physical activity. Probably need to be updated, but there have been efforts over the last decade related to integrating nutrition and physical activity messaging into medical school curriculums. I guess one more comment. Okay, well, I'd like to thank Brooke Belay for organizing this great panel, and for the panelists for your incredible contributions.